This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Be a Man, a story in 6 chapters. Chapter 1, That's When You Need Somebody. So, can you first tell me your name?
Mario.
And you don't want to use your last name? Okay. How old are you?
14.
Where do you live?
In a house.
14-year-old Mario lives somewhere in Grand Rapids. He doesn't want to be identified on the air. He sits dressed in a plain white t-shirt, khaki-colored pants, and white low-top Chuck Taylor All-Stars. We're in a sunny hallway at the downtown Grand Rapids campus of Grand Valley State University. Mario is here attending a summer program from the Hispanic Center of West Michigan, a program meant to help keep kids on track academically while school is out. Next year, Mario will be in the 8th grade at a middle school in Grand Rapids.
Is it a pretty good school?
Kind of.
What's not good about it?
There's too much gangs and stuff like that.
Mario stares at the floor, bouncing his knees nervously. He tells me about his friend, who used to be a good kid, a nice kid. A few years ago, that friend joined a gang.
So people ever try to get you to join up?
Yeah.
So what do they say to you? What's their pitch?
They say, come on, get in, it's good. And then I say no.
What do they say is good about it?
They say that they get to fight people and stuff like that.
That's what's good about it?
I guess that's what they say.
Do they make money?
Yeah, when they sell drugs and stuff like that.
Mario says he knows he's not going to join a gang. He's seen what it did to his friend, and he's got an older brother who helps steer him away from bad influences. But still, he says at his school, the boys like him, the boys not in any gang, to him it seems like they're the minority.
So there's more kids in the gang than kids not in the gang.
Yeah.
So what's that like for the kid who's not in the gang?
It's random. It feels random, awkward, because it makes you want to feel like you want to be part of it, but you don't. Like, when you get in fights, people beat you up, and then you have no backup. That's when you need somebody.
Being in a gang seems safer, even for a good kid like Mario. And there's constant pressure to join up. And this pressure Mario feels has a lot to do with his neighborhood and the kids at his school. But there's one other big risk factor that we have to consider. Mario is a boy. Let's hear from someone else who goes to the same middle school.
My name's Lydia Lopez.
Lydia backs up what Mario told me. A lot of kids at her school are in gangs. And I ask if any of these kids are girls.
No, not that I know of. I only know boys, a lot of them.
This is not to say that girls don't get into trouble, of course. Lydia has been in as many fights as Mario. And girls do join gangs. But it's rare enough that Lydia can't think of any examples at her school.
No.
Like, why don't girls join the gangs?
Like, for me, my opinion is because, like, it's not worth it. I mostly see boys in gangs. I don't really see girls in it.
This hour, we are going to try to figure out what is going on with boys. Why are they more likely to join gangs? Why are they much more likely to get involved in all kinds of trouble as men? Why are men so much more violent? According to FBI crime statistics, 80% of all arrests for violent crime in America involve men. That includes almost 90% of all murder and manslaughter arrests, and nearly 99% of all arrests for rape. And the thing that's maybe the most crazy to me about all of this is that these numbers are not surprising to anyone. We already know and expect that men will commit violent crimes at far higher rates than women. That's just the way it is. But I mean, that is crazy, right? That one group making up 50% of the population would be responsible for 90% of the murders? How can we see that and just accept it? And it turns out it's not just the extreme cases where men are more likely to go off track. In the past few decades, men and boys have started falling behind on all kinds of measures, particularly in schools. There is a connection between these things: low academic achievement, high rates of crime. This is what it means to be a man. are listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I am Dustin Dwyer. This hour, the story of why boys are falling behind in school and why men are filling up prisons. Our story, told in 6 chapters. Stay with us. Chapter 2. Just because it's common doesn't mean it's normal. River Rouge High School in June.
Is it at your class?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah.
You come down and check?
Yeah.
Teacher Janine Van Alken is leading me down a narrow hallway that's lined with maroon lockers and jam-packed with lumbering teenagers. This hallway is always busy, between classes, during classes. Van Alken is trying to nudge them along.
This is an issue all year long. Well, at the end of the year, it's a little bit more serious because kids are, you know, they've kind of shut down a little bit at the end of the year. So,
shortly after the start of second hour, Van Alken turns a corner to see a big crowd of students spilling out of their classrooms, all focused on a scene farther down the hall.
Something happening? Are we rubbernecking, ladies, or are we part of this?
Down the hall, the school security guard is trying to separate 2 girls. The situation seems to be calming down. Then all of a sudden, in the everyday life of a school, it can be hard to think about things like gender. Every student is an individual. Girls fight, boys fight, girls ace tests, boys ace tests. But if you step back and look at statistical outcomes, it's clear that something is going wrong with the boys. In Michigan last year, the dropout rate for boys was nearly 50% higher than for girls. 1 in 8 male students dropped out of high school within 4 years. Girls outperform boys at nearly every school in the state. But here at River Rouge, the numbers are particularly bad. According to state data last year, 76% of girls graduated on time at River Rouge, compared to only 50% of boys. After the fight clears, I head into Ramon Hernandez's classroom. Neither he nor Van Alken have a class this hour, so they sit down to try to decompress.
Woohoo!
Way to start off the day.
You know, it makes me want to wear tennis shoes to work.
Hernandez and Van Alken both grew up in River Rouge. They say the city's always had a rough side. It's a small town just across from Detroit's southwest border. It's surrounded on 3 sides by heavy industry, an oil refinery to the west, coal-fired power plant to the east, a steel mill to the south. And River Rouge High School is a troubled school. On the official statewide ranking, River Rouge is listed in the first percentile, meaning it's worse than 99% of all schools in Michigan. I ask Hernandez how his math students did this year. He sighs and says, not as well as I'd hoped.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge when you have factors such as poverty, malnutrition, and our students don't have coping skills. They don't have coping skills. They don't know how to deal well with adversity.
And that has an impact on how the students deal with each other and how they handle conflict.
If somebody says something that they don't like, it's automatically, it turns,
aggressive,
and it escalates to violence.
Hernandez says this is true for both boys and girls at the school. But when I sat down with Corey Parker, the school's dean of students, he told me he sees differences in how boys and girls at River Rouge handle conflicts.
Yes. With girls, usually it's a girl-on-girl conflict, and it's going to possibly end there. However, the guys are a lot different. The guys are, it's not going to be a one-on-one deal. It's going to be me and my friends versus you and your friends. So the severity does change.
And that's partially because boys face a different expectation than girls. Parker says if a boy is from a certain area or a certain block, there's an assumption that they will fall in with the other guys from that same place.
And that particular group of guys may not be good guys at all, but it's just assumed. So, yeah, they do have some influences to become a part of something that they may not even have any interest in. But because of that peer pressure that you grew up with us, you live around a block from us, you hang with us type deal, then some of those guys really get pushed and squeezed into that particular relationship with those other guys. We don't see that with the girls at all.
Administrators at River Rouge recognize these gender differences in behavior, and it plays a role in how they try to reach the troubled students. One way they do that is through the 180 program. For 1 hour out of the day, the most at-risk students at River Rouge are pulled out of their normal classrooms to take part in the 180 program.
Okay, gentlemen, can we put your devices away, please?
Students in the 180 program are separated by gender, so it's girls 1 hour, boys the next. I set in on the boys' class. Instructor Marisha Graham says the idea of the program is to give these students a safe place to talk about what's going on in their lives and help them work through it.
We try to deal with the 16 hours outside of school. So when they come here, we give them a space to talk about personal, social, domestic issues, as well as dealing with some of their academic challenges.
And the program works a little like group therapy. Graham and her co-instructor, Michael Fenton, prod the reluctant teenagers to talk about their lives. It's one of the ground rules that what's said in this room doesn't get shared outside of it, so we won't be playing any of the students' voices here. But over the course of the hour, it was clear that all these young men are dealing with serious issues. Only a few of them have fathers in their lives. Only a few of them even want fathers in their lives. When Graham asks how many of them have seen their mother hit by a man, half the hands in the room go up. For these kids, violence is a part of everyday life. Ultimately, the problem is that too many young boys end up modeling what they see in the world.
And I have to tell them, just because it's common, because it's what you see every day, it doesn't make it normal. And that's the biggest challenge, you know? They feel like it's normal to see young men on the block all day. Nope, in normal, functional societies, people are generally at work, you know, or being educated. But to them, it's like, no, they're not. Not in my neighborhood.
Graham says the girls she sees have an easier time imagining a life outside of what they see. The boys have to be shown the way.
Thank you all for sharing.
Next, the curious case of a disadvantaged group that turned the tables. Girls, boys, and academic success. And in 10 minutes, the story of Roderick Daniels.
I take total responsibility, but yeah. Almost all my kids been on robberies.
You are listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Be a Man, a story in 6 chapters. Chapter 3, The Terrain is Shifting. It's a rare case in sociology. Usually a group of people that lags behind on whatever measure of success, a group sociologists might call a disadvantaged group. They don't usually turn the tables and suddenly become the advantaged group. But that's just what happened between boys and girls in schools over the past 4 decades. Claudia Bookman has spent the past 10 years tracking the trend. She's a professor of sociology at Ohio State University. She's worked side by side with another researcher, Thomas DePriet. Their work hasn't always been taken seriously.
When we first started doing this research, we applied for grant money and we tried to publish some of our findings. And the pushback was always, well, who cares about this? Because there's a gender wage gap, you know, that women still, you know, it doesn't matter how much education women get, they're still getting paid less than men.
But those education differences are striking. Women are more likely to get a 4-year degree. Women now get 60% of all master's degrees, according to Bookman. Women get the majority of law degrees and medical degrees. And just in 2004, only 9 years ago, women for the first time started getting the majority of PhDs in the country. Women haven't yet achieved equality in the workplace, but the writing is on the wall.
The terrain is shifting in so many ways, and we're in a time where I don't think we can forecast what the world's going to look like 20 years from now in terms of those gender wage gaps, for example.
At least if you look at the trends in education, it seems likely that women will continue to make progress. This on its own is probably not cause for alarm for many people. But the problem isn't just that girls are outperforming boys. The problem is that many boys aren't even trying. Bookman and DePreet have seen the evidence in large-scale national surveys, surveys that ask student questions about how they feel about school.
We find that there are large gender differences in all of those kinds of questions. So boys report that they're, on average, boys are less likely to feel close to their teachers. They're less likely to report that they are engaged in school, that they enjoy going to school than girls do. They spend less time on homework.
And there's another wrinkle here that's even more troubling. It's something that sociologists like Bookman are just beginning to understand. The gender differences in school achievement get worse when you look at kids from low-income families.
The evidence is building that boys seem particularly vulnerable to resource deficits.
So things like poverty, unstable homes, unstable neighborhoods, low-quality schools, these things seem to affect boys differently than girls. Being a boy is like a multiplier for other risk factors. So Bookman says, if you want to understand why there's a growing achievement gap based on income, or why the racial achievement gap persists in schools, you have to look at gender too.
By no means do I mean to imply then that this has to be a zero-sum game where we put all our efforts, you know, we neglect girls and focus on boys. That's not what I'm advocating here. But I think the more research can pinpoint precisely which groups are, you know, contributing, say, to that overall achievement gap, and then from there go to the question of, well, why is that happening? That's going to make our policy responses much more appropriate.
Chapter 4, Coach Would Take Care of It. Let's go back to this phrase, resource deficits. Doug Belisle grew up with more than a few resource deficits.
I remember having to scounge for food all throughout most of my life. It's like the fridge was always empty, the cupboards were always empty. So whatever little food we did have, I tried to prepare for me and my brothers.
A box of macaroni, whatever spices he could find in the cupboards. It usually wasn't enough.
I mean, my brother got up during the middle of the night and would get into food, so that would take away from everybody else. But he was little. He didn't know better. So tried to explain it to him as best as I could.
All of this created stress, as it would for any kid. Belisle says his grades weren't so great, but he actually loved school.
I mean, we got free lunch at school, so, you know, I made the most of my lunches at school just so, you know, I knew I had something good to eat. So, you know, I looked forward to going to school to get out of the house because the house was a mess, you know, to get away from my parents because, I didn't want to be at home at all.
School was the one place he felt comfortable, at least until the incident. In Belisle's freshman year of high school, he was assigned a science project on electronics. Belisle brought in an old PlayStation for the class to tear apart and study.
It wasn't me taking it apart. It was some other people taking it apart, and they took it apart, and then just a bunch of roaches just flew out of it.
The incident followed him for years.
You know, it was all about the roaches because that's what they knew of. So then they made the assumption that my house was extremely dirty, and it was. I mean, I'm not going to lie about it, but, you know, I went to school to get away from my home life, and then my home life came to school with me.
This is the point in the story where things could have started going really badly for Belisle. He was a freshman in high school, troubled at home, outcast at school. A particularly bad recipe for boys. But Belisle still had one thing going for him. He was on the wrestling team at school.
And then once I got to the wrestling room, everything was fine because nobody made fun of anybody because we were all family in the wrestling room. Nobody said anything bad, and if they did, coach would take care of it.
The team was Belisle's family. This isn't some high school sports cliche. For many boys, sports teams are the closest thing to a family that they've really got. It's what saved Belle Isle. He eventually moved out of his parents' house and finished high school.
My grades improved because I wasn't as stressed out, and my wrestling coach always had a tutor. You know, he had a tutoring class after schools for his wrestlers, so we'd always keep our grades up so we could wrestle.
Belle Isle's experience is not rare. When I was visiting River Rouge High School, I asked teachers what characteristics separated the boys who did well in class and the boys who didn't. They told me the boys who do well are all in sports. Corey Parker, River Rouge's dean of students, who we heard from earlier, he's also the head football coach. He told me most of his players don't have dads at home. They don't even have dads who show up on Friday night.
I am the dad. Those kids will run through brick walls for me because of the love that I have to show them outside of football. So a lot of things we do has, you know, a very small percentage with actually X and O's and player development. It's a lot to do with just showing them what they might not have received from a man before, that encouragement, that leadership, that love.
You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. Our program this hour, Be a Man, a story in 6 chapters. Chapter 5, we're going to pray for our fathers.
How many of you, who all got fathers in their life right now?
We'll see
your dad every day.
Grand Rapids, in the hallway of Korean Grace Christian Reformed Church.
We'll see their real dad every day.
Well, not every day, but like
Roderick Daniels is taking prayer requests.
So we're going to pray. That's going to be one of our main prayers, is that we're going to pray for our fathers, man. Because just because your dad ain't around, that don't mean he might not be going through something too.
Daniels knows what it's like to be a father in need of a prayer. But right now he's focused on these kids, a group of teenage boys from a rough neighborhood on the southeast side of Grand Rapids. Daniels asked about fathers because he knows a lot of these boys don't have much of a father in their life. Fathers are disappearing all around. In the United States, 35% of all children live with a single mom. In this neighborhood, in this 1 square mile census tract, 63% of kids live with a single mom.
All right. Well, my prayer request is that wherever our fathers is at, because, you know, I'm grown now, but wherever you guys' fathers are at, man, we just praying that God send his angels to protect them. Because as a father, I know that y'all dad love y'all, even though he love you. And he hurt because he's not in you guys' life like he should for those that aren't. So don't ever think your pops is out there just wandering the street and ain't thinking about you. He might be going through something too. So that's why we got to pray for him. So let's pray.
I first met Roderick Daniels in the winter. I drove out to his house on a Wednesday night when the yard was still covered in snow. It's a quiet place with a red barn out back. But inside was a flurry of activity. Roderick's wife, Nicole, introduced me to the 5 kids who live at home. Jerry, Nicole, Rain, Nicholas, James, and Solomon. All of them in the kitchen at the same time.
We're just getting in from a basketball game. And so we're just grabbing a little bite to eat.
Behind her on the wall was a whiteboard, which they'd made into a calendar. A very packed calendar.
It's colorful. It's red markings on there and black and green. So the red is the most important stuff on the calendar. So it's a lot of red.
Basketball games, baseball games, track meets, church. This is what life is like now for the Daniels family. But it is not what life has always been like. After the kids get their food and settle down with a movie, Roderick and Nicole tell me about the life before all this. It was a bad life.
Actually, one time, Rod, he was... before he went to prison, he was so gone off the drugs that he did a robbery with the children in the car. Yeah. He pulled up at the gas station, went inside the gas station, robbed the clerk, and got back in the car and drove off. And the children came home and they said, "Mom, we was just in a robbery." You told him, "Babe, have what you done when you was high."
That's horrible.
Yeah, it is.
I'm saved now. I just want to say God is totally in my life. I'm filled with the Holy Spirit. So my life has totally changed. So that's why I don't have no problem with being transparent. Yeah. I did my time. I'm paying my restitution. So they take money out of my check. So God is good. I take total responsibility. But yeah, almost all my kids been on robberies.
How Roderick got to that point, strung out on drugs, holding up gas stations with his kids in the car, it all started when he was growing up in Southern California. He just kind of slipped into it.
You just start hanging out. I mean, you got to make friends when you're a kid. So then you eventually start going over to the house, and then you get attracted to the bling of the streets, you know, people riding around in cars and getting money. And for us, it was a crack era, so we were selling dope. So it was just usually about keeping up with the rap music and the whole culture, man. It was all, that's what we did, so.
Around the same time, thousands of miles away, Nicole was growing up in Grand Rapids. And she was always a good kid, but she was living in a bad neighborhood, too. She was seeing the people around her get into drugs and crime. So after high school, she decided she wanted to try being bad.
It seemed to like the other people was having fun. And so that's why I said, well, let me try this. Let me try to sell me some drugs. And let me try to, you know, smoke me some cigarettes and weed and, you know, just. And so I end up getting deep into it, into that lifestyle.
After Roderick moved to Grand Rapids, they were in it together. Side by side.
Since I've been with Nicole, I've been shot 5 times. I got shot twice in the head. Been to prison on her twice. You know, and
I've seen him walk up to this guy, and the guy pulled out a gun, and they were really close to each other, maybe not even a foot away from each other. And the guy pulled out the gun and just began to shoot him. All I could see is the gun jerking back in the guy's hand. And then the guy just took off running, and Rod got in the car and in his truck and drove, reversed all the way down the street because it was a long street, and drove himself to the hospital.
Small little beef, and he pulled out a gun and started shooting. So, man, I didn't know you remember them details like that. I only remember all that, bagging up and all that.
Because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I couldn't believe it. I was standing right there.
That was the second time I got shot. I really, 3 incidents. The third time when I got shot in the head. Crazy.
And still, being shot 5 times on 3 separate occasions wasn't enough to convince Roderick or Nicole to leave their life of crime. Neither was the heroin addiction that eventually got to them both. What did it was going to prison for the second time. Roderick was convicted for the gas station robbery, the one where all the kids were in the car. It forced him to get off heroin. It forced him to look at himself, finally.
I was sitting in a cell in Jackson with bars behind me and bars in front of me. A cell where a full-size bed couldn't even fit in there. With a sink, an old sink, an old porcelain sink, because them bad prison was built in the 1800s. And there's birds flying in and out because there's birds get up in there. And just looking out at those bars, man, it just feeling really lost, feeling real small.
Roderick had been to prison before, but this time was different.
That whole "I love my family," all that stuff didn't matter. You know, it not that it didn't matter, but that wasn't gonna work no more. I love my wife, I love my kids, I gotta get out here and do what I gotta do, and you know, all that I missed, been there, did that, too many times, in and out, in. So it was like, I was just sick and tired of all of it. I was just sick and tired of everything, you know, sick and tired of playing prison, sick and tired of talking to people in prison, sick and tired of, you know, just trying to work the system and trying to be good in prison and get out and get my parole, and that was just like, that was the transition, you know. It was a moment, but then it was a moment that said, this is going to take some work. It's not going to happen. Jesus didn't come in my cell and sit down and talk to me or nothing like that. It wasn't a wall. It wasn't a moment like that. It was like a shift. And God told me, okay, son, now we got to put some work in. It's going to take some work because your mind is messed up, you know.
He served 5 years in prison. And in that 5 years, Nicole got clean too. They didn't coordinate it or work together. They just both had the same shift at nearly the same time. For both of them, this is evidence of God working in their lives. And when Roderick got out of prison, it was time to be a dad. Within a few days of getting out, he was called up for a meeting with his son's principal. Nicholas had been caught stealing.
I come up to the school and just, you know, they already know I've been to prison. Here I was big, I had been working out and all this stuff, so I don't know if they had some type of stereotype. I'm sure they did.
So this large, bald, tattooed ex-convict goes into the principal's office with his wife and son.
And I just bawled my eyes out, man, crying. And he was crying, and Nicole was crying, and the principal was crying. And I was just looking at him, and I said, dude, I refuse to let the system, you know, just get you like that, man. I refuse to you be a thief. You're not going to be no thief. You're not going to go to prison like I did. You're not going to go to juvenile. And it meant a lot to him, man. It was like that was a shift for him.
Next, our chapter on Roderick Daniels continues as he goes out into the community and tries to offer young men something that will really keep them away from crime, job training. And coming up in 10 minutes, learning to hit back.
I would never expect to turn around and just deck somebody. It took me by surprise, and I thought, well, maybe now they kind of learned.
You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. You are listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Be a Man, a story in 6 chapters. And now, chapter 5 continues.
I think we should take the truck. That way they see the truck.
Grand Rapids, southeast side again. Roderick Daniels and Tim Johnson are standing outside in the cold of winter trying to figure out how to get the word out about Powerhouse. The big bright orange moving van with the words Powerhouse plastered on the side seems like it can only help. Powerhouse is an outreach ministry, part of Resurrection Life Church. Res Life is where Daniels was saved and where he and his wife Nicole centered their lives after giving up drugs and crime. Powerhouse is a way to reach kids in the rough neighborhood where they used to live.
What up, y'all?
Yeah!
How y'all winter been so far?
Not right. Good.
We're going to start up next week. They're going to pass Tim over there. He over in the truck. Or Tim.
We're going to start what next week?
Powerhouse. We ain't starting this.
These are all kids Daniels knows. Kids he's trying to reach.
I want to be a part of them kids' lives, man, until they get older and they come back and say, I remember you, Mr. Roger, when you used to come. I'm doing real good. Because a lot of them don't have fathers. If you could really hear some of these stories, they all typical stories. All of them know somebody locked up. All of them know somebody that's been shot.
This is the next phase of Daniels' life. He survived gunshots and drug addiction and prison. He came home to be a father. Now he wants to be a mentor to the kids who don't have a strong family of their own. You hear all the time about how many boys in single-parent homes lack a positive male role model in their lives. But volunteering to be that role model takes a surprising amount of advertising. Daniels is always putting himself out there, trying to find new ways to reach kids. Like when Daniels heads next to the Boys and Girls Club up the street to pass out Powerhouse flyers. He knows the director here, a man named Mike Remo.
Mike, I'm going to get a hold of you, see if you can come talk to the kids.
Okay. Put me in, coach.
Okay.
For real. Because that's my assignment, man. That's what God will have me to do, man, is just to be a conduit and try to people, you know, where I've been, so I want to let people know that it's real, you know. Change is real.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get a hold of you then.
After meeting Roderick Daniels and listening to him speak, I came away thinking that he has an incredibly valuable message. And I wondered honestly why people weren't banging down his door to have him speak in front of kids. And then I talked to Ivory Toldson.
When I was very young, I used to always say I was tired of people bringing people who came out of jail to talk to me. Because jail wasn't necessarily anything that I was aspiring to. But I was confused about a lot of different things.
Toldson is a professor at Howard University and editor of the Journal of Negro Education. He grew up in a rough neighborhood, like Daniels, like a lot of black kids, and he saw a lot of his friends turn to the streets. They maybe could have used a speech from Daniels. But Toldson had other questions on his mind about how to get to college, what career path he could take.
So I had all these questions when I was young, but it seems like every time they brought somebody to talk to people like me, it was someone who served time in prison. And I kind of got tired of that.
Toldson says the problem is young black males are constantly being told about the crisis they are in. All those negative statistics you've probably heard about black males. If you are a black male, you've heard them 1,000 times more. Some of them aren't even true. Like, for example, have you ever heard someone say that there are more black men in prison than in college? It's repeated all the time. Even President Obama has said it. But it's totally not true. Toldson disproved it himself. He says ultimately, this barrage of negative messages about black males, it puts the focus on the wrong thing. The goal and eventually the policy becomes just to avoid a negative, like prison, instead of promoting all the many positive paths young black men can take.
What they want to be more than anything else is to be able to make a good living in this society. And so they need to see people who are doing that. And they need to understand, you know, what was that path that you took to, you know, become a detective or to become head of a radio station or, you know, any number of different things.
And so let's go back to Roderick Daniels for a minute, because he actually gets this. His plan for mentorship isn't just about prayers and public speaking. He's trying to start a new nonprofit. He calls it Kingmakers. I met up with Daniels, this time finally in some warmer weather, while he was hard at work on a home remodel on a leafy street in Grand Rapids. He was blasting gospel music while he worked.
Hey, so what's good?
Daniels has been in the construction business for years. Even during the bad times, even when he was addicted to heroin, he tried to keep working. Now he does it as a second job, in addition to his work at his church.
I can only get over here on, you know, in the afternoons or on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. But I got my boy Monty, he over here.
This is the kind of mentorship Daniels is trying to get started. Mentorship through work and opportunity.
Just Kingmakers work. You couldn't take it, but guess what? You are still here. Because anytime I could give a guy a chance to make some money, you know. And Monty, he a good dude. He don't smoke no weed. He don't do nothing.
And actually, Monty, who Roderick keeps calling Monty, has an incredible story, too. Dramod Cartman is his full name. People call him Monty. He met Roderick through his wife. The wife, Monty, Roderick, they all spent a lot of time in a bad part of Grand Rapids around Prospect Street. Cartman grew up surrounded by bad influences. But those influences never got to him. To him, it was simple.
I just used my head. Like, man, they should have gang fights on Prospect, I'd try to break it up or just stand there and watch. I wasn't getting into that. They used to be like, oh, you're part of our gang. I'm like, no, I ain't.
You say it like it's so easy, man. Like, you just have to say no to a gang.
I mean, it is. Well, for me, it is the way I was raised by my mom.
And that's kind of an incredible story because Cartman told me his mom was a single working mom with 8 kids, and they all stayed away from the bad influences.
2 of my sisters just graduated from Michigan State. Another one of my brothers just graduated from Grant Valley. So, like, ain't none of us, like, been in trouble.
Cartman says he knew other kids who had good parents, even kids with both parents in the home, and they still got caught up in the bad things going on around Prospect Street. But he says one other benefit he always had is that he was in competition with his brothers and sisters. They all wanted to be the best. They expected to be the best. And that set up each one of them to succeed. You're listening to State of Opportunity on Michigan Radio. I'm Dustin Dwyer. This hour, Be a Man, a story in 6 chapters. Chapter 6. We can easily take advantage of this kid. First, a warning. This chapter contains some offensive language, which will come up in about 2 minutes. Now, we know that boys are falling behind girls in school. We know that boys are more likely to get involved in violence or crime. You will hear people say that men are just like that. Testosterone levels, larger muscles, you know, all that stuff. Men have been more violent for thousands and thousands of years. It worked out great for men in the cavemen days. But in 2013 in America, things are not looking good for the manly man.
In many ways, the world is changing around us, and the notion that men need to be men, you know, whatever that means, whether it means being, you know, using your physical strength in a job, well, those kinds of jobs are falling by the wayside.
That's Claudia Bookman again, the sociologist at Ohio State. And after spending about a decade looking at how and why boys are falling behind in education, Bookman says she believes it has a lot to do with the expectations they get put on males, especially uncertain young males.
Boys who grow up in working class households where the father was or is a blue collar worker are often given the perception that because the father didn't do well in school and that wasn't an academic achievement, wasn't a pathway to his middle class lifestyle, those sons may be getting the message that, you know, it's doing well in school doesn't really matter.
What we're really talking about here are expectations. If you go back to what we heard a few minutes ago with Dramod Cartman, a big part of how he was able to avoid bad influences is that he just grew up with the expectation that he would succeed in school. And the thing is, many boys grow up with a certain default expectation that's not very helpful in school. The expectation to be a man.
Some kid came up to me and he grabbed me by the shirt. He had picked on me before, but I usually ignored him.
Dan Hornbeck is 20 years old. The story he's telling happened when he was in 5th grade.
I pushed him away, and then he punched me in the face. And I ended up crying all the way to the bus and all the way home.
Crying was a bad idea.
And that's when it just kind of escalated, because I knew, okay, well, this kid cries. We can easily take advantage of this kid. And, you know, it just went from there.
Basically, for the next 2 years, Hornbeck's life was hell.
They would call me a faggot. They would call me a bitch or a pussy or call me gay or something like that. It was just a lot of harsh words. I got a lot of physical abuse as well.
In the hallway, kids would knock books out of his hand. They'd slap him. One time, a group of boys slammed him on the ground and started beating his legs with sticks. His parents tried to get the school to intervene. They tried to get the parents of the bullies to intervene. None of it helped. It just made it worse. All this time, Hornbeck says he wasn't trying very hard with his schoolwork. I asked him why not.
Probably because when I got bullied, I was afraid that if I got super good grades, I'd get bullied from another perspective. Like, oh, you're a geek, oh, you're a nerd, you study too much, you know, that kind of thing.
It wasn't worth the risk. Hornbeck was already near a breaking point with the constant bullying that now had been going on for 2 years. So finally, he tried something he hadn't tried before.
This kid comes up to me and he's like, you're such a fag, you're so gay. And, you know, I turned around and I was like, you know, one of these days someone's going to deck you in the face. And then he goes, what, you? And I turned around and I decked him.
It was a turning point. A kid who'd never been violent finally resorted to violence to protect himself. There are probably a few ways to describe what happened in that moment. One way some people would describe it, Hornbeck finally learned to be a man.
I ended up getting suspended that day, but when I came home, I kind of sat and I realized, I was like, wow, I was like, I didn't expect myself to do that. I would never expect to turn around and just deck somebody. It took me by surprise, and I was like, well, maybe now they kind of learned.
And they did. It worked. The bullying didn't stop right away, but that was the turning point. And it changed Hornbeck's life. He joined the wrestling team. He started martial arts. He's a martial arts instructor to this day. He spends a lot of his time at the gym.
I've told my girlfriend this too. I told her, he's like, you know, I was like, I can't quit because sometimes I feel like they're going to come back and I'm going to get bullied because now they know I don't do this stuff and now I'm weak again. And it's a crazy thought because I know it won't ever happen. But then again, the feeling I get is like, I can't stop this stuff. I'm going to become weak again. And I just don't want that.
Hornbeck looks back and he's actually grateful for the bullies, for the motivation that they gave him. He channeled it in a positive way. But he never really got his grades together. He didn't go to a 4-year college. He's going to school now to get back on track. In the fall, actually, he expects to become a father.
Boy or girl?
Boy.
Boy?
Yep.
So what do you think about the expectations for him?
Well, like I've told other people, I've told him, you know, the thing I wish the most is that I hope he never goes through what I went through. And I hope he finds something that he loves, and whatever it is, I'm going to support him either way.
So if he's soft, you'll be okay with that?
I will be okay with that, yep. Because I know I can hopefully mold him into something, you know, that would make him tougher. So, but yeah, I would be all right with that.
Epilogue.
There are outliers that people see.
Joan Silk is a researcher at the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at Arizona State University. She has studied gender extensively, but not in humans, in primates.
I watched a group of bonnet macaques for a very long time, and I knew a male who had never been very high-ranking.
He was smaller than the other males and less aggressive. He lived at the Davis Primate Center in California, part of a community of bonnet macaques that were studied by researchers like Silk. He didn't have a name.
He had a number. So in this population, the animals had been numbered, and his number was number 24.
And though he wasn't high-ranking among his primate peers, the humans were in love with him.
He was such a sweetie. He had big brown eyes. He was really cute. And he was very sweet.
Silk says that male bonnet macaques are already much friendlier and less aggressive than males of some other primates. Although it is common for males in most primate species to use violence as a way to achieve social dominance, it's not the only model. And in some species, such as bonobos, it's the females that actually run the show and dole out physical punishment. But even within species, there are those who rebel against gender expectations. Like number 24.
He just loved little babies. I mean, you know, we thought he was sweet because he wasn't aggressive and didn't go around, you know, bossing other animals around. But that's our very anthropomorphic value system, that it's sweeter to, you know, to hug infants or juveniles than to chase them around.
Think about, say, 10,000 years ago. Humans may not have been as sympathetic to number 24. It has not been common for most of human history for males to take an interest in child rearing. And if it is in our biology for males to be more aggressive, if it is a default setting for males to commit 80% of violent crime in a society, if it is a hardwired fact that boys will not sit in a classroom, patiently listen to a teacher, and do their homework, at least not to the extent that girls will, then boys are in trouble in today's economy. But if there's another factor at play, then there's another path.
I mean, the thing is that here we are, modern humans, and we know even if we have strong biological predispositions, the question is, there are two things. One is, how much do men and women overlap? So how much overlap is there in traits amongst males and females? And then what role does culture have in shifting our expectations and ideas about appropriate behavior for each gender?
The truth is, our culture has already shifted. Expectations of what it means to be a man have changed. But they haven't changed for everyone. And the boys who grow up under the old expectations are the boys most likely to trail the girls in school, most likely to become another crime statistic. You've been listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. This documentary was informed by the Public Insight Network. The State of Opportunity team includes Jennifer Guerra, Sarah Alvarez, Kimberly Springer, Gabrielle Emanuel, and Alex Wilson. Vincent Duffy was our editor. Tamar Charney is the executive producer of State of Opportunity. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Dustin Dwyer.
It's good to be a man these days.
Little boy, be a man.
Just be a man about it.
What does it take to be a man?
It takes more than words for you to be a man.
It must be swift as the coursing river, with all the force of a great typhoon,
be a man.
With all the strength of a raging fire, mysterious as the dark side of
Support for State of Opportunity comes from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.